Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Ross Allen. He's the director for North America of Britain's Department for International Trade, and he has prior experience in foreign and defense policy and in commercial banking. Mr. Allen, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Great to have time with you, Grant. Hi.
So I want to start with a basic question, and we'll get to some things that are going on in your country regarding trade in different ways. But first of all, could you just briefly describe to our listeners your portfolio as the director for North America of Britain's Department of International Trade?
Absolutely, yeah. We're here to do three things, really. We help British companies export to the US and Canada. So I oversee a team that covers both those countries. The second thing we do is encourage inward investment into the UK. Mm-hmm. So if there are American or Canadian companies looking to set up an operation in Europe, we're here to encourage them to look to the UK and then to help them set up in the UK if they want to. And the third thing is helping British companies who are out here sort of in the market. So there are actually quite a lot of UK firms set up in the US and Canada. And we're also here to help them. We want them to be successful. So it's the exports in one direction and the inward investment back to the UK and then helping British companies out here in the market.
Okay, great. And I would think, based on what you just described and thinking about what's going on in the world for the last couple of years, I would think that there are two kind of large scale and perhaps equally unpredictable forces that are affecting your thoughts as you go about that job and thinking about British trade with the U.S., and that would be Brexit on the one hand and the Trump administration's statements and actions regarding trade on the other. Is that true? Are those the two sort of big elephants in your room as you're thinking about these issues?
Yeah, I mean, those two are both certainly factors and things that have affected our work, and I'm happy to talk a little bit about, each of those.
Okay.
I guess the third one would be the sort of general trends in the economy. So we're looking to focus as much as we can on the sort of sectors and industries that are going to grow in the future. So we're also, I guess the third one I'd pick would be just sort of more general trends in terms of tech and the evolution of certain sectors. You know, we're doing a lot more in, for example, green energy and probably less in terms of fossil fuels than we were, you know, a few years ago. But certainly, yeah, I'm happy to start with sort of Brexit and then the sort of wider tariffs piece.
Right, and I'll get into some of those things you mentioned as the third category when a little bit later in the conversation I have some questions about Syracuse and the relations with Britain in terms of trade or the Syracuse area. So let's start with Brexit, though. And it's both a moving and a non-moving target. But first of all, just remind our listeners where Britain and Europe currently are on Brexit. And I want to note that we're talking on April 18th, so things can change. But where do things stand right now?
So, Grant, it's very kind of you to say it's a moving and a non-moving target. You've got excellent British understatement skills. As I speak, we're still a member of the EU. For those of your listeners who don't follow it that closely, we had a referendum, a public vote back in 2016, and we voted overall to leave the European Union. And we've been sort of negotiating the terms of our departure since then. Our Prime Minister has negotiated, in effect, two things with the EU, a withdrawal agreement, which would set out the terms of our departure, and then a shorter political declaration, which describes our intention to have a very close, strong partnership in the future. She has brought those to the House of Commons and tried three times to get them through the House of Commons, so far unsuccessfully. And there's obviously that's been the sort of focus of a lot of the media coverage and so on. Where we are now, and as you say, we're talking on April the 18th, but Prime Minister went back to the European Council in the last couple of weeks and agreed a further extension while we continue to reflect on sort of what we do next. So the terms of that extension, that would take us up to October the 31st, later this year. That has been described as a so-called flextension. So the idea is that if during that period we actually were able to sort of agree something ourselves domestically that the EU is happy with, we could leave sooner. But October the 31st is in effect the new sort of final deadline. And then what's happening domestically? I'd say a couple of things. The Prime Minister has opened a dialogue with the opposition party in the UK. So the Prime Minister is from the Conservative Party. The main opposition party is the Labour Party. She's opened a discussion with them about whether there are ways in which the deal that she's negotiated could be tweaked in some way, and that this is focusing particularly on the future partnership with the EU in such a way that the Labour Party would be willing, or enough members of the Labour Party would be willing to support the deal. And those talks are continuing. The other thing that I think is happening, which is probably a good thing, is that we're actually on, and again, I'm speaking to you ahead of the Easter weekend, our MPs are on their Easter break. and I think it's possible that there's been quite a sort of febrile atmosphere in Westminster, lots of very, very vigorous, very healthy debate. But it may well be a good thing if I think, MPs have gone back to their constituencies and they're talking to their constituencies and they're having a little bit of time out of Westminster, thinking about what it is they really want. And then when they come back after that Easter recess, I'm sure there will be further efforts to see if there's some common ground that can be reached and we can land something that a majority of our members of parliament can support, which the EU, is also willing to agree. And that's certainly the intention. The Prime Minister has said it's strongly her preference to leave with a deal. And obviously in the future, we're keen to have a very strong partnership with Europe. We're not, we can't do anything about geography. We will still be a European country. We will still want to trade a lot with the rest of Europe in terms of our defence and security relationship. Europe will be very important to us in the future. So the aim is to preserve as much of that as we can. And then use the opportunity of leaving the EU to do more globally. So, and we'll come on to this, I'm sure, but potentially we could then do more with the US and with Canada and with other, sort of some of the big growing economies around the world.
Yeah, I do want to explore that a little bit later. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Ross Allen, the United Kingdom's North America Director in the Department for International Trade. But let me just stick with Brexit here itself just for another minute or two. Some observers and advocates for this saw the controversy and the inability so far to generate an agreement as an opportunity for a rethink of the entire question, to have even a second referendum. There did seem to be some what we would call here in the States buyer's remorse over the outcome of that vote. Is that a real possibility at this point, or has that train left the station?
I represent the government, and the government's view is that we've had a referendum, and actually the outcome was quite clear, and that what the government should do is work hard to reach an agreement that delivers what people voted for. So the government's the direction the government is planning to go in is delivering on the outcome of the referendum that we held, that's obviously what we're intending to do. And the Prime Minister has been fairly clear that she doesn't think that holding another referendum would be either respecting the outcome of the first one, or necessarily that it would even sort of take us anywhere more helpful. And certainly, sort of some independent commentators have questioned, I think, whether it would actually help move the situation on or not. There are lots of questions about what the question might be. If it was another very narrow outcome, what would that mean, and so on. Some of our ministers have slightly different takes on this. So some of them said that although they don't support it, they can see that in some circumstances it might be an option, a legitimate option. Parliament has actually voted on that a few times and has voted against. So overall, there hasn't been a majority of MPs who've wanted to hold a second referendum. So at the moment, I don't think it's something that the government, it's not something the government is working towards, and personally, I don't think it's particularly likely. But the government, the really challenging thing with all of this, which has been, reported in the media, is that Parliament has been very, very clear several times what it doesn't like, and lots of different options have been voted down. The challenge has been to get Parliament to sort of positively vote for something that they can, a majority of MPs can agree on as a positive way forward. And that's the government's aim, is to get the deal that the Prime Minister has negotiated, or if there's some variation of that that the Labour Party could support, then that through Parliament. And that will be their priority when Parliament resumes.
So you have a background in crisis management and communications in the past, and it does certainly seem like Brexit has become a crisis for the British government. I guess I'm dropping the British understatement here for this. at least that's the way it's been portrayed in the States. So I was just curious, is there any advice that you would have for communications from the government regarding this issue, things perhaps that might have been done or that could be done better going forward?
Well, I would challenge the categorization of it as a crisis. I mean,
okay.
My view is it's certainly a difficult thing that we're working our way through. You could argue, and people have argued, that actually we're demonstrating that our political institutions are quite resilient. It's certainly a very major decision that we've taken. It's, you know, the EU is an organisation where it's forerunner. We joined back in the 1970s, and we have over time become sort of deeply integrated within various bits of sort of European law and regulation and so on. And extracting ourselves from that was always going to be very, very difficult. Some people's views are quite heavily reflect some of the press coverage, which would have you believe that this is sort of the only thing we're doing. But I would again, challenge that quite heavily. I mean, the government is doing lots of other good and positive things at the same time. So just to give you one very small example, and this covers different governments from different parties over the sort of past, say, 15 years. Renewable energy, in the UK, we have now the most installed offshore wind capacity in the world. We've reduced our carbon emissions by 40% as a country while growing our economy by two-thirds. That's an incredibly, positive story. I think we're seen globally as one of the sort of leaders in terms of making that transition. And that's probably something that's going to affect, that overall issue, climate and so on, is going to affect all of us and our children over a very, very long time period. And I think we in the UK have got a really positive story to tell there. And then there's lots of other things we're doing domestically. So I work a lot on the economy. In the UK, since 2010, the government has done a really, really good job of reducing steadily the government deficit and then starting to try to pay down some of the debt. And again, that puts us in a much stronger position over the long term. So the government's been taking sort of difficult long-term decisions, whether it's on climate or sort of changing the direction of the economy, which not every other country has done. And I, sometimes wish that we could get more attention for that. Also the sort of feel of innovation. We've got some great things going on in our university sector. Our companies are doing brilliantly. Tech companies from the US and Canada. Lots of them moving to the UK. I think we've attracted a fifth of the international sort of people who've moved within that sector have come to the UK. So there is an incredibly positive story in the background about the UK, and that's a story that I'm very keen to tell a bit more loudly. But you're right that Brexit is something that has sucked up certainly a lot of the sort of media coverage.
Well, we could use your help on the deficit and debt reduction. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Ross Allen. He's the Director for North America of Britain's Department for International Trade, and we've been discussing Brexit. So let's shift now to trade and North America and some of the things that your office is concerned with. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that Brexit actually might open up some opportunities for better trade between Britain and the U.S. So tell me a little bit about how you see that working.
Yeah, so as a member of the EU, one of the things that comes with that for countries that are member states is that the EU negotiates trade policy on your behalf. So right now we are still an EU member state, so that's still the case. So the EU represents us in international trade talks. When we leave, we will take over responsibility for that ourselves. We'll have an independent trade policy. And we have said that among the priority countries that we would like to do or negotiate and then implement free trade agreements with are the US. We would like to do a new free trade agreement with America. And then I know you have some listeners in southern Ontario. We're also very keen to roll over the agreement that Canada has with the UK and then over time look to perhaps build on and strengthen and deepen that relationship too. So that's really the prize here, that the countries that we'd negotiate with, I think the ones in the first wave, we would love to do something with America, Australia, New Zealand, and we're exploring joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership as another option. Mm. And then beyond that, there are other, obviously, big growing economies worldwide that we would look to negotiate our own free trade arrangements with. And if we're doing that on our own, rather than as a member of the EU, we could potentially find agreements that are a bit more flexible, a bit more nimble, a bit more suited to us specifically as the UK, and that don't have to take into account the interests of 27 other members of the EU. And the good news is that there's appetite for this certainly on the UK side, but we know from this US administration, from the president down, There is enthusiasm for negotiating and reaching an agreement with us. We've had several rounds of sort of preparatory talks. We're not actually allowed to negotiate formally until we leave the EU, but we have been exploring what an agreement might look like. It's possible it might not necessarily take the form of a full-blown FTA. There may be things that we could do differently, could break it down into sort of smaller chunks. We could do things that don't necessarily always fall inside a traditional FTA. So we could do things on services, particularly financial services, or some stuff in terms of regulation and so on. So there's all sorts of opportunities there and appetite on both sides to do that.
I was wondering on that point, the Trump administration has had some trade-oriented conflicts with other nations, and sometimes it's been, I think, from the standpoint of those other countries, unpredictable in some of its actions. So you're seeing this as an opportunity to engage in those negotiations for Britain itself rather than being connected to the rest of the EU. Has there been any discussions or concerns about starting down a path and then having the terrain shift under your feet and have to reorient on the fly?
Not particularly, no. And we're feeling quite confident and positive about those negotiations. So a month or so back, I think the US side actually set out what would be its negotiating objectives for a negotiation with the UK. And there weren't really any sort of nasty surprises in there. They were mostly things that we were expecting. There will be some difficult areas. There always are in these things. The obvious one is always agriculture, and there are always some sort of difficult negotiations around agriculture, for example. But I think if you look at the nature of the UK economy and the nature of the US economy, we start from quite sort of similar places, obviously on a smaller scale in our case, but we are talking mostly to sort of relatively high-skilled and by global standards sort of high-wage economies. Where there's a lot of interaction already. We're already each other's biggest investment partners. British companies in the US employ over 1 million Americans every day, and the same and the vice versa in the UK. So there's lots to build on. And I don't think in a US domestic context that an agreement with the UK would face the opposition that we've seen or be quite so controversial as perhaps some other agreements are. Because I don't think that people would have that fear that somehow a free trade agreement with the UK would lead to the loss of lots of jobs or manufacturing sites closing in one country and moving to the other. I don't think anybody would be looking to shut a site in the UK or the US to move it to the other one simply to for lower wages, for example. That's not really how it works. And both of our economies are now significantly dominated by services and so on. So I think they're quite complementary economies. There's a lot going on already and scope to do a lot more together.
If you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the Director for North America and Britain's Department for International Trade, Ross Allen. So let's move and talk more specifically about then that relationship economically and the trade relationship between Britain and the Syracuse area. And I've looked at some of the data that's been generated by your office, and it's really striking. And I have to say it was surprising to me. That, if I understood it correctly, Britain is Onondaga County, and that's the county that surrounds Syracuse. It's the county's third largest export market, with yearly goods exports to Britain of $73 million and service exports of $92 million. And a goods export, let me just ask you to break that down. Goods exports seem pretty self-explanatory, but tell me a little bit more about what a services export is, because that figure was $92 million.
Yeah, absolutely. And this reflects what I was saying earlier about the broader trend towards services. So we're obviously very keen to support the goods trade too, and that's important. I was actually, I'm based in New York City, but I was in the Syracuse area at the end of last year and able also to see some of this for myself, visit companies and so on in the area. But on the services side, you've got, for example, companies in the travel sector, in insurance, in wider financial services, management and consulting services, telecoms and so on. Those are all areas that have been big services exports for the Syracuse area to the UK. And it's worth, this all sounds sometimes, I think, quite theoretical unless you start thinking about it in terms of jobs. And by our calculations and the work that we've done, we think around 1,000 jobs in the in a sort of greater Syracuse area are supported by those exports. So that's very real, and that's actually what makes me come to work each day. A lot of what my team do generates jobs and growth in both of the countries that we work with. You know, we're by that trading relationship and that investment relationship, we're generating jobs and growth in the UK, jobs and growth in the US, and jobs and growth in Canada. And that's one of the few things that everybody wants.
So break that down more specifically for me, and let's take travel, because travel in the data that I looked at was the single biggest subcategory of export of services to Britain from Syracuse, and I was scratching my head about that, just sort of thinking how that would work. So explain that to me. Is that someone providing a travel service that is based in the Syracuse area that is then being purchased, that service is being purchased by someone in Britain? Is that what that means?
It could be.
Okay.
The only danger with these statistics is actually digging into them, and the categories and so on is quite complicated. So it could be that, or it could be sales of services from companies based in the Syracuse area. I was looking at who some of the UK-affiliated companies, you know, their subsidiaries are in the area. And I saw there's one that's First Student Charter Bus Rental, which is transportation services. So it may also be like an element of it may, for example, be a company like that operating in the local area, and some of that may be categorised as exports.
Okay.
This is the thing that's unusual with services exports is that, unlike with goods exports, you can't go and watch something being loaded onto a ship. And some of them are, you know, a little bit harder to get your head around. But that's probably made up of a bunch of different things.
And on the goods side, are there any patterns of goods that are being exported from the Syracuse area to Britain, with some more popular than others?
Yeah, definitely. So we've got things, for example, like medical equipment and supplies, navigational and measurement instruments is another one of these slightly oddly named categories. Pharmaceuticals and medicines, another big area. Electrical equipment and components is another. Obviously, pharmaceuticals and medicines is a big one between the two countries. So I'm based in New York City, but we cover the tri-state area. And within that area as a whole, pharmaceuticals and life sciences and so on is a big part of that economy. But also in the UK, we have both very, very large sort of global, you know, multinational companies like GlaxoSmithKline, AstraZeneca and so on, but also lots of small innovative companies doing, you know, sort of really pioneering new things. So that's, again, an area where, and when we're talking about the future economy and the future economic relationship, that's certainly a big focus for us, is all around innovation in healthcare, innovation in life sciences. We just ran recently a major event in New York where one of the themes that we were looking at was so-called 5 extra years of healthy life. Mm. So rather than just saying, can we help everybody get to a certain age, it's also about quality of life in that period. So what are the innovations that we can do between the UK, the US, Canada and so on, and share some of this? Because that, again, is something that we all want. That's another big focus for us.
So I wanted to shift ground a little bit, and with the time we have left, and ask you a couple questions to get you to reflect on your time in the United States as someone from Britain. And the first one is, what do you think is the most common misimpression that Americans have about Britain that you regularly encounter as you're going around and talking with folks?
A brilliant question. So I should say I've been posted here twice. So I was in Washington, D.C. between 2008 to 10, working at our embassy, and I couldn't wait to get back. I love being in America, and when there was an opportunity to come back and be based in New York, I jumped at that. I had a son who was born here in 2017 who has dual citizenship. He's, he's US-UK. And another one due in June who will, I assume, have dual citizenship as well. And I feel an extra connection to the US now, having two of my three children having, US citizenship. And for me, a big reason why I'm so enthusiastic about the job that I do is that it really benefits both countries. On your question specifically, on misperceptions of the UK, I guess a couple. One is it's not foggy. you get people who are obsessed with the idea that we have lots of fog. Which I'm 40 and I don't remember there ever being much fog. I think that was probably sort of 50 or 60 years ago. And it was more to do with the sort of level of industry at the time. But we're not foggy. And the other one is the food. We actually have spectacularly good food now across lots of parts of the UK. You know, lots of Michelin-starred restaurants and so on, but also even, you know, regular food that you would get in sort of everyday restaurants has actually improved lots. That one I accept what probably was the case sort of 20, 25 years ago. I do remember growing up probably that reputation was deserved, but definitely no more. And I'd also say, if your listeners are thinking about where to go on vacation, the UK is brilliant. It's relatively small. I think New York State is about the same sort of size as just England, like within the UK. You can get around easily. We speak the same language, kind of. And the exchange rate currently is very good for US visitors to the UK. You know, that makes your vacation a lot cheaper. So I would say book now, go now, and have a fantastic time in the UK.
You're a good salesman. Let me flip that question around. You've talked already about your enthusiasm for being in the States, and as you mentioned, you live in New York City with your family. What is it that you miss most about London? And we've only got a couple minutes left. What do you miss most?
The obvious thing that you miss actually most is not a place, but more, you know, people. So family. It's a 5-hour time difference, 7-hour flight, and people come over regularly to see us. When they find out that, you know, I'm in New York and I have a spare room, it's, you know, there's a sort of fairly long line of people wanting to come and stay. But yeah, I think it's more family that you miss rather than place. And also my soccer team. So I now only get to see my soccer team sort of once or
but
twice
you, you
a
just,
year.
You just
lucky.
Called it a soccer team and not a football team, not a football club.
But I'm trying to fit in. I'm trying to speak the same language.
And who's your club that you follow?
They're called Crystal Palace FC, and they're doing okay this season. We have promotion and relegation in our league, so
right.
I'm hoping that they will stay up. And they've been a few seasons now in the top league, which is good for us.
And finally, we've just got about 30 seconds left. But is there one thing that you most admire about the United States? I know that, you know, there are things about Britain that you would probably like to import here. But what about the United States do you most admire? In 15
seconds. I
would say,
yeah, can-do attitude, like entrepreneurialism, can-do attitude, and that sense of sort of boundless possibility. You know, you visit the US, it's enormous. That sense of sort of optimism and the scope to just do incredible things here.
That's great. That was Ross Allen. Mr. Allen, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.